Who took my keys?
WBAI New York, we're at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Coming up at 11, we'll be Living for the City. At 12 noon, the Gary Null Show. But right now at 10 a.m., coming up next is Project Censored.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim.
Welcome to the Project Censored Radio Show. I'm your host for this week, Eleanor Goldfield. And it was recently Martin Luther King Jr. Day, and you may have noticed that the U.S. Empire and all its racist, capitalist, and imperialist cheerleaders were also cheerleading Dr. King. If this made you angry, confused, or just curious as to what Dr. King's legacy actually is in the context of U.S. Empire, you're in the right place. Jacqueline Lookman joins the show again to discuss Dr. King's actual legacy, what got him killed, what we're missing, and how we can truly honor Dr. King. Next up, Sitara Gandahari from Detention Watch Network joins the show to walk us through the Biden administration's quote-unquote updates to immigration policy, which, as Sitara points out, are hardly updates but rather a continuation of right-wing, xenophobic, anti-immigrant, and also failed policies that will cause immeasurable harm to thousands. All this and more coming up now on Project Censored.
To the apocalypse, got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide wars fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons.
Thank you, everyone, so much for joining us at the Project Censored Radio Show. We're very glad to be joined once again on the show by Jacqueline Lookman, who is the co-host of the radio show By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik with Sean Blackman. She is the moderator of Plymouth Congregational United Church of Christ and a member of the church's Board of Social Action, an organizer with the Black Alliance for Peace and with Pan-African Community Action in Washington, D.C. Jackie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Jackie, I wanted to ask you on the show here because we are recording this a couple of days just before Martin Luther King Day, and I can only assume that there will be a scourge of racist, capitalist, imperialist douche canoes quoting Dr. King. And I just wanted to share this one little nugget from last year, actually. The FBI, ladies and gentlemen, tweeted out, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. once said, quote, life's most persistent and urgent question is, what are you doing for others? End quote. This MLK Day and every day, the FBI remains dedicated to service and committed to protecting our communities. I have a hard time saying that without actually laughing and vomiting at the same time. Jackie, could you take us through just a little bit of this remarkably twisted irony here?
It really is remarkably twisted, because let's not ever forget, for people who don't know, that the FBI was the architect and the implementer of a little program called COINTELPRO, which spied on left activists, anti-war activists, student activists, Vietnam era anti-war activists, and most notably the American Indian Movement and Black liberation organizations and leaders. That would include Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. under the purview of J. Edgar Hoover, who got his career started in the then named Bureau of Investigation, because it wasn't a federal agency then. He actually started his career surveilling and eventually getting setting up to be deported Marcus Garvey of the the Universal Negro Improvement Association through this mail fraud scheme. And what did Marcus Garvey do to deserve this? He just wanted Black people throughout the diaspora to be an independent nation, you know, outside of this empire that had abused, subjugated, oppressed, enslaved, Yeah, all of that, Africans throughout the diaspora. So he wasn't just talking about the United States. He was also talking about the colonies of the U.S. ally and the former largest imperialist nation, the United Kingdom. So J. Edgar Hoover not only made his bones in the Federal Bureau, the Bureau of Investigation in the early years, he built an entire career off of surveilling what he described as threats to the American way. He believed that Black nationalist and Black liberation groups were looking for the emergence of a Black messiah to lead them out from under the watchful, paternalistic eye of American exceptionalism, which we were never looking for a messiah. We were just looking for a way out. And that's all that was. But, you know, the empires can never give up its subjects. So when you think of the FBI in the modern era, I want, and in the context of Martin Luther King Jr. or any other radical Black leader that the FBI can somehow claim to honor, I want people to immediately think of COINTELPRO. And remember that it was the FBI that surveilled Martin Luther King Jr., wiretapped his phones, sent him letters telling him that he should kill himself, sent his wife tape recordings that alleged to be Dr. King having an affair with another woman. For the record, Mrs. Coretta Scott King has always said that those recordings were bogus. But this is what the FBI did. By the way, the King family actually sued the FBI, I believe, a few years ago. And although the outcome of the civil suit was not to directly implicate the FBI in the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., which is what people were looking for, because come on now, you don't put all that effort, you don't do all of that, spend all of that money and resources and effort just to let somebody be like, okay, well, we've done enough. No, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated because he began to have or express more radical views away from capitalism. He began to speak publicly against the war in Vietnam. And he began to speak publicly about the need to reallocate funds for the redistribution of the massive wealth in this country to go to the poor. That sounds a lot like socialism to me, because that's what he was talking about. He literally, Dr. King wrote in a letter to his then fiance, Coretta Scott, and I just find that this is one of the most romantic things I've ever read in my life, that he writes to her as they were courting, as they were dating, "I guess you know that my views are more socialistic than most." And he starts talking about the need to redistribute wealth. And this is long before the Beyond Vietnam speech and before he was a member or before he was the leader of the civil rights movement that he was chosen to do. Martin Luther King Jr. always seemed to have had an alternative view of this American system in regard to the working class and the poor, particularly Black people. He understood very early that it didn't work for us. But there was no reason for it not to work, because if the same system could spend all the money that it was spending in Vietnam by the time he's talking about the Vietnam War, because during the entire civil rights era, he didn't speak out against the war. He was focused on desegregation. He was focused on ending Jim Crow. He was focused on equality of access for Black people. The Vietnam War created a crisis of conscience, I think, for someone who understood that the resources that were being sent out of this country to fight people who are also oppressed by neocolonial imperialism the French in Vietnam were trying to regain their colonies. And he understood that that was connected to the imperialism here in the United States. He recognized that he could not, in good conscience, ignore that while, you know, people were fighting against him, because let's be clear, Martin Luther King Jr. was not popular when he was doing all of this. He was not popular in the American population. If you look at polls from that period of time, over 60% of the people in this country polled said that he was stirring up trouble, that he was doing too much, that he was making things worse. So people in this country were not like, oh, we love Martin Luther King Jr. And then, no, they weren't. They wanted that man to shut up and go away. And all he was doing was dealing with Jim Crow and integration. But it really broke the straw that broke the camel's back for not just the American population, but for the empire itself, was when he began to speak out against the Vietnam War and to condemn, to critique and condemn capitalism. He was making those connections that the empire didn't want him to make. So he was assassinated at that point in his public career, not because of the sit-ins, not because of the I Have a Dream speech that everybody likes to quote, that people only quote that part of the speech, but they don't pay any attention to anything else he said in that speech, which do contain nuggets of the very condemnation of capitalism and militarism and racism, the triple evils that he called them. Nobody ever talks about those. So for the FBI to honor Martin Luther King Jr. is literally like a serial killer who took the life of your sister, sending you a birthday card saying, thinking of her on her birthday. That's how sick and twisted this is.
Yeah, absolutely, Jackie. And I really appreciate you creating that context about the connecting of issues, because that's another thing that I wanted to discuss. Because as you pointed out, he was murdered shortly after connecting those issues. And there's actually a good book by Dr. William F. Pepper called The Plot to Kill King, which talks a lot about this and about how, you know, the FBI created a fall guy and all of that, all of those details. It's an incredibly detailed book that goes through all this. But with regards to that, I'm also curious, because there's a lot of focus on Dr. King, rightfully so, in the U.S. in terms of these movements. But it also seems that if you start digging, to me, as somebody who's not Black and started digging from an outside perspective, these threads, these connective threads, are a huge part of Black organizing. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, like, these threads that are connected that Dr. King picked up and, like, brought to the spotlight.
I mean, the thing is that it is difficult to believe, but it's absolutely true, is that all of the things, excuse me, that Dr. King was analyzing and raising in his public life, in his political career, are still issues that we are dealing with today. That's the thing that is so incredibly important for us to keep in mind as organizers when we approach this day in particular, because the empire whitewashed his image. In, I think it was 1994, the United States Congress passed a decree that designated Martin Luther King Jr.'s holiday as a day of service. They officially did this to, and I hate to sound like that kind of conspiratorial person, but I don't see that they have done this for any other holiday in this country, honoring a person. But it sure is funny that this Congress of millionaires and mostly white people found it necessary to pass a piece of legislation to tell the people who have been pushing for a federal holiday to honor this man who meant so much to our struggle for liberation, that no, you can't just have a day off. This is what you are going to do to honor him. We're going to tell you what you're going to do to honor him. Most people don't even know that this idea of a day of service around Martin Luther King Jr.'s day comes from a congressional decree. But we've adopted it as, well, this must be something that King wanted us to do because, after all, he was a man of service.
You are listening to the Project Censored Radio Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Eleanor Goldfield. We'll now continue our conversation with Jacqueline Lookman.
When you look at what Dr. King actually said when he talked about the pressing issues facing Black people in particular, but all working class and poor people generally in this country, and this government's role and what it should do to address these issues, King said things like this, and I have to read these quotes directly because I don't want to get them wrong, because it is Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., by the way, so I'm not going to mess with that. So he said about capitalism in particular, we have deluded ourselves into believing the myth that capitalism grew and prospered out of the Protestant ethic of hard work and sacrifice. This is a man who is a Christian Baptist pastor calling BS on this Protestant work ethic stuff. He said, the fact is that capitalism was built on the exploitation and suffering of Black slaves and continues to thrive on the exploitation of the poor, Black and white, here and abroad. If Negroes and poor whites do not participate in the free flow of wealth within our economy, they will forever be poor, giving their energies, their talents, and their limited funds to the consumer market, but reaping few benefits and services in return. The way to end poverty is to end the exploitation of the poor, ensure them a fair share of the government services and the nation's resources. He said this to the American, the Negro American Labor Council in 1961. So here we are in 2023, and the conversations around socialism and the exploitation and the poor of the poor and the heightened interrogation of the utility of capitalism. People are, of course, attributing this heightened conversation in this country to the campaigns of Bernie Sanders, and that's fine. But for us organizers, for us African organizers, we understand these interrogations came from people, not just him, but were popularized to a certain degree by Martin Luther King Jr. Something else he said that he talked about that we face today. Dr. King visited Harlem in 1964 when a police officer killed 15-year-old James Powell. King called for a civilian review board that would make police accountable to the public. Now, for us today, especially as members of Pan-African Community Action, we are advocates of community control over the police. And that means that the community controls the apparatus of public safety, from hiring cops to reviewing them to firing them, discipline, all of that. What King was advocating wasn't quite CCOP, but it was closer to it than I think most people were thinking about at the time. But just like today, when we talk about community control over any of our institutions in our communities, because we believe in Pan-African Community Action, that the people who live in the community should control all of the institutions in our communities, police, school, food, public health, public safety, everything. And of course, we get a lot of pushback, a lot of criticism from that. Guess what? So did Dr. King. He absolutely did. He was criticized by local politicians in Harlem who ran him out of town for his comments. And that happened 50 years ago. He spoke a lot in his Beyond Vietnam speech about how the United States at the time was spending an obscene amount of money in 1967, measures on killing a bunch of brown people, or killing a bunch of, sometimes he did call them, you know, yellow, but he meant the Vietnamese people, killing a bunch of poor peasants whose only crime was not wanting capitalism and imperialist rule. So King talked very much about how the money that was used to wage the war in Vietnam, where most of the soldiers in the United States were sent disproportionately from Black, Latino, and poor white communities, sent them overseas to kill people who just did not want to be subjugated by capitalism and imperialism, only to have those American men come back to this country and continue to face the capitalist imperialist subjugation and inequality that money that went to Vietnam could have and should have been used to address the issues facing the poor and working class. So he absolutely called for the reallocation of funds, the end to U.S. militarism, because it was the evils of militarism and racism and poverty that continue to perpetuate the oppression of working class and poor people in this country. So he was calling for an end to not just the Vietnam War, but an end to war spending in the United States in general, because the United States has always spent more, well, maybe not always, probably since World War II, spent more money on so-called defense than it has spent on social programs, on what King called social uplift programs, poverty reducing programs. Imagine how much more true that is today, Eleanor, as the United States has just spent over $100 billion, sent $100 billion in some form or another to Ukraine. We cannot get around the fact that this government, with a domestic law enforcement, a domestic federal law enforcement agency that is honoring Martin Luther King Jr., which is itself a fascist agency because it's within a fascist government. The U.S. is a fascist government. This government is sending boatloads of money to a government in Ukraine that has banned labor unions, that has now outlawed an entire religion, that has stripped citizenship of priests, that has shut down opposition television stations and newspapers, has outlawed, made it illegal for opposition political parties to exist, and that absolutely does have far-right elements in the parliament making these decisions, and has formally incorporated quite a few thousand literal neo-Nazis in their army. So if we cannot see that what Dr. King was talking about in 65, 66, 67, 68, when he talked about the triple evils of racism, poverty, and militarism, if we cannot make these connections today, then we're not the revolutionaries we claim to be. It's our responsibility as organizers, as African organizers, to carry on that legacy of the radical Dr. King and continue to raise these issues, regardless of the ideological pushback we get, even from those poor, deluded people on the left who think that siding with the empire in this issue of the militarism in regard to Ukraine is a righteous thing because they've been indoctrinated to hate Russia so much. And that's a whole nother conversation, but yeah.
It is indeed, but and a very vital one. But it's, yes, there's so many offshoots from this because Dr. King combined so many issues and really placed them under that singular umbrella of U.S. empire. And I kind of want to wrap up here with this idea, because COINTELPRO didn't end, it just shifted. FBI still very, very much spies on, infiltrates, and tries to kill leftist movements, and has just very recently raided Pan-African offices, and of course continues to spy on anyone even loosely related with anything like Black Lives Matter or things like that. And so Dr. King was a very large target for them, because he was very easy to aim at, literally and figuratively. So I'm curious, what are your thoughts as an organizer on having a kind of like a singular leader like this that they can label, you know, like a Black Messiah, and not just from outside danger, but also in terms of an inside organizing perspective? What are your thoughts on having a kind of like singular person like that?
I think that's one of the lessons that African organizers, have learned, that as I said before, we're not looking for a messiah, because that this kind of a singular focus on one person, on a Moses to lead us out of the wilderness of you know, the trap that is America. That's a very, I think, immature and you know, outdated kind of view of African organizing, or any organizing, and to be honest. For us, our focus is, and should be, for those who are watching who maybe haven't thought of this, our focus really should not be on individuals, because, and I'm not saying this in the context of Dr. King, I'm saying this in the context of, this is just how human beings kind of are. When you focus all of your organizational efforts on what one person says you should or should not do, you can create a cult of personality, and you might lose focus of your actual mission. Your mission should be liberation. It should be the examination and the critique and the condemnation of capitalism. Focus toward building the alternative of socialism to address the insufficiencies and the exploitations of capitalism, providing political education around those issues, also connecting the material conditions that people face, police brutality, income inequality, healthcare disparities, all of these kinds of climate issues, all of these things that people are grappling with, struggling with, facing and drowning under today. We need to be raising consciousness about internationalism, because it is no accident that people around the world, working class, poor, peasant, indigenous, Afro-descended people around the world, particularly in the global South and in some places on the continent of Africa, are engaged in a pitched struggle, an intense struggle for their self-determination and their land and their human rights against right-wing governments and their connected forces that are always, always backed by the United States and its allies. It is not a mistake that we don't hear in corporate media about those struggles. These things are important for us to know, because their struggles are connected to our struggles. There is no way we win against the empire we live in unless we connect with the people who are the recipients of the foreign policies that come from this empire, just like we're the recipients of the domestic policy that are created in this empire. So those things need to be our focus. Our focus needs to be on the issues we are fighting, how we fight them, what our solutions are, what we can do to struggle toward those solutions. Because if we do all those things, Eleanor, if we focus on all of those things, we will win, but we will not win focusing on a messiah internally. And we certainly won't win being national isolationists in any context.
You're listening to the Project Censored Radio Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host this week, Eleanor Goldfield. We'll continue our program after this brief break, so stay with us. Hard times when you ain't sent for braces, feed the belly of the beast with they pitchforks, rich chores done by the people that get ignored. Ya se armó, ya se despertaron, it's a whole awakening. La alarma ya sonó hace rato, los que quieren buscan, pero nos apodan como vagos. We're the same ones hustling on every level, ten los datos. Walk a mile in our shoes, abróchense los zapatos. I've been scoping y'all dudes, y'all ain't been working like I do. Why y'all work ya? It hurts ya. You claim I'm stealing jobs, oh, Peter Piper claimed he picked them, he just underpaid Pablo, but there ain't a paper trail when you living in the shadows. We America's ghostwriters, the credit's only borrowed. It's a matter of time before the checks all come. But
immigrants, we get the job done. Look how far I come. Look how far I come. Look how far I come. We get the job done. Look how far I come. Look how far I come. Look how far I come. Immigrants, we get the job done.
Yeah.
Welcome, everyone, to the Project Censored Radio Show. Thanks for joining us. We are very glad right now to be speaking to Sitare Gandahari, who is the Advocacy Director at Detention Watch Network, a national coalition building power through collective advocacy, grassroots organizing, and strategic communications to abolish immigration detention in the United States. Sitare collaborates with DWN members and coalition partners across the country to advance DWN's mission. Sitare, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So I wanted to dive in to the Biden administration's recently released updates to immigration policy, which are kind of not updates, but more of the same. And among these updates, quote unquote, there is an expansion of Title 42. So could you first take us through what Title 42 is and what that expansion entails?
Sure. I'd like to start by saying that Biden's, you know, new immigration enforcement policies, which, like you said, is really a continuation of more of the same, continues a failed decades-long deterrence strategy, which doesn't work, and is really a page from the same xenophobic, anti-immigrant playbook as the previous administration. And these policies will cause immeasurable harm for people who are seeking safety in the United States. To answer your question, Title 42 is a law that gives the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, authority to refuse entry of certain goods and people at the border when the CDC determines that there's a possibility of communicable disease transmission in the U.S. Despite the objections of CDC officials at the time, the Trump administration pushed the agency to exercise this authority at the start of the COVID-19 pandemic. Public health experts then and now widely agree that there is no public health justification for using Title 42 during the COVID-19 pandemic. Throughout much of the first couple years of the pandemic, travel to and from the U.S. Continued for many people, yet Title 42 was in place and used to restrict entry of people at the border who were seeking humanitarian protection in the U.S. And now that in our day-to-day lives, there are virtually no pandemic protections that remain, it's more clear than ever before that there was and there is no public health reason to have it in place. Yet the Biden administration has continued to use it primarily for political purposes, as did the previous administration under Trump. So, you know, I should clarify that the Biden administration has tried to lift the ban, and they've been dealing with a court battle. But at the same time, you know, the administration was very, very slow to start winding it down. And, you know, from our perspective, they've really put up a lackluster fight. Now, on top of that, they have announced that they plan to actually expand the use of Title 42. So while the courts for now have prevented them from lifting it, nowhere have they been required to expand it. And yet that's what they're doing here under this new policy to allow for rapid expulsions of people from from Cuba, from Haiti, and Nicaragua and Venezuela to Mexico. You know, under Title 42, people that enter between ports of entry can be rapidly expelled, which is really just a euphemism for deported without any, you know, real process as it used to be, without any chance to apply for asylum, which goes against U.S. law and international agreements. You know, before this announcement, whoever was expelled really depended on who Mexico was willing to accept. You know, it's been people from Mexico, from Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador. But the recent developments have extended this agreement with Mexico to include people from Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, Venezuela. And so people who generally haven't been accepted by Mexico will end up in Immigration and Customs Enforcement or Customs and Border Protection detention, you know, basically in jail awaiting flights to be expelled to their home countries. And I think Haiti is a really critical example to talk about because, you know, under Title 42 previously, Haitians would spend time in ICE detention and then, you know, be put on flights to be expelled. And now it's going to be that much easier to expel Haitians to Mexico. You know, from the beginning, this policy was intended to close down our borders to Black and brown migrants who were seeking safety. It was never about public health, and that continues under the Biden administration and under this new policy.
Yeah, absolutely. That is very clear. And I also understand that it's not just Title 42. The Biden administration pointed out that even if Title 42 is removed, Title 8 remains in place to quickly force asylum seekers and migrants out of the U.S. What is Title 8 compared to Title 42?
Sure. So Title 8 is just another way to refer to the Immigration and Nationality Act, which is the body of laws that generally govern U.S. immigration process. So expedited removal is a process within Title 8, which was added to the immigration laws in 1996. And it gives immigration officers the ability to more rapidly deport people who are apprehended at the border or who have entered the U.S. very recently. Over the years, expedited removal has been applied in, you know, various ways, depending on the administration. Legally, even under expedited removal, it shouldn't apply to certain categories of people, including refugees and asylum seekers. But of course, in practice, people who are subject to expedited removal don't know their rights. They often, you know, don't know that they have to express their fear. There's rarely an opportunity to show that they're eligible for asylum with an immigration officer. They don't have an opportunity to appear before a judge. They don't go to court. So the use of expedited removal has really always been a concern, and it's really troubling that the Biden administration is planning to expand its use. The other thing that the Biden administration announced was an intention to issue a new transit ban rule, which further attacks asylum. So essentially, the Biden admin is proposing rules that would ban people from applying for asylum in the U.S. if they don't first apply for protection in the countries that they pass through on their way to the U.S. And this is something that, again, the Trump administration attempted repeatedly and was repeatedly struck down by the courts. People ended up being denied asylum and other protections, spending prolonged periods of time in ICE detention, which as a system is notorious for abuse and neglect. It has caused family separation and other harms. Taken together, I just want to be really clear. This administration has co-signed a right-wing agenda that promotes fear and demonizes immigrants.
Yeah, thank you. I think that is a succinct label to put on it for sure. And to get a little bit more into the details, as I understand it, there is a so-called humanitarian parole program, which really sounds like an oxymoron, in place for people from those four countries that you mentioned. And it's more restrictive than your typical asylum seeking, not just in what's demanded for application, but it only lasts for 2 years, which is really odd, at which point the person could be forcefully deported. So could you talk a little bit about this so-called humanitarian parole program?
Yeah. So what the administration is implementing is a program whereby people in these, you know, four countries, Nicaragua, Cuba, and Haiti, and this was really modeled after a similar recently rolled out program for Venezuelans. They can apply for this temporary, you know, humanitarian parole from their home country. To be eligible, people have to have someone in the U.S. that's willing to sponsor them. Like you said, they're, you know, it's a temporary program. They're here for 2 years. There's a cap on the number of people who can be enrolled. But really, it completely disregards the fact that people who are fleeing for safety don't have the luxury of going through a lengthy application process from home. They may not have someone in the U.S. or the financial means to buy a plane ticket. You know, they have to get themselves here. You know, once they get here, they can apply for asylum or other protections. Of course, there's no guarantee. And like you said, they could end up being deported. But it's really absurd and not really how it works for most people who are fleeing for safety. You know, we absolutely need pathways for people to be able to come to the U.S. And this is, you know, an option that may work for some people. But basically what happens is that for folks who are applying, for folks from these countries who don't now use this new process, asylum will be that much harder for them to access because they will be subject to immediate expulsion to Mexico under this new agreement. So it's really putting people from these countries in a bind. If they don't have the means to apply for this new program, but they're fleeing for their safety, many of them are just going to be out of luck. And it's not the way the asylum system is supposed to work.
Yeah, absolutely. And there seems to be also a tech divide. I was reading that potential, asylum seekers or migrants apply from their home country. They can use a phone app. Okay. And they also have, as you mentioned, have to have a U.S. sponsor. And I'm just sitting here wondering, like, that sounds like a lot of work for me. And I'm sitting in a place that is not, you know, that is not difficult to live in day to day. And even I think that I gotta get an app and then I have to figure out how it works. And what if that's not my main language? I mean, can you talk about this tech divide here and whether you see this as yet another hurdle and a way to exclude folks?
It's a huge barrier. And I mean, honestly, it's absurd. You know, imagine yourself, you're in a situation, you're facing political persecution, you're facing violence in your home country. You know, there are pressures that people are facing that, let's be real, are often the result of, you know, U.S. foreign policy and global capitalism that is causing people to be in these situations where they have to get out. And the idea that you have the time first of all, to be able to have a phone. Then, like you said, there's the language barrier. Then, like, let me just take my time and fill out this application. Meanwhile, I'm actually literally running for my life. I don't know what other words to use other than absurd. And I think, you know, all I can think is that they don't know what asylum means. Like, I don't think it means what they think it means. And so there's a tech divide, there's a political divide. I think fundamentally what this signals is that this administration again is just continuing this policy that it's been a common thread among administrations from both parties, that we want to deter people from coming to the U.S. We don't want them to come unless and if it serves our political interests, right? So all of a sudden, when there's a political reason for us to be welcoming of Ukrainians, for example, as we should, then it's really easy to get everyone here. But if it doesn't serve our political interests, if it doesn't serve our economic interests in a very obvious way, then we're not welcoming. And I think that's really the root of the problem here. It's about where do we stand as a country, and are we welcoming or not? And I think the answer has been pretty clear through, at least when it comes to governments. I know that most of us, my neighbors and everyone I talk to, we know we have this, we want to be welcoming. We want to support each other. And it strengthens our communities when we do that. It's not what's happening at the higher levels.
No, definitely not. And I want to piggyback on what you so rightfully pointed out, that it always bothers me when people discuss migration in the U.S. that they don't talk about U.S. imperialism. And in fact, last June, the UN Refugee Agency reported that for the first time on record, the global number of people forced to flee their homes had crossed the 100 million mark. And of course, some of that is climate chaos, but that could also be related to the U.S. since the U.S. military is the largest single contributor of greenhouse gases, equal to about 140 nations just by itself. And I find it so telling that the Biden administration targets Cuba, Nicaragua, Venezuela, and Haiti, four nations that have been decimated by U.S. sanctions and meddling for decades. In the case of Haiti, you know, hundreds of years. And now these people can't claim asylum despite the fact that they're fleeing conditions structured, at least in part, by U.S. imperialism. And so I think that that is a very important part to note.
You're listening to the Project Censored radio show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host this week, Eleanor Goldfield. We'll now continue our conversation with Detention Watch Network's Sitare Gandahari.
Also, in terms of how these people are treated if they do make it to a U.S. border, you mentioned several times detention centers, which have rightfully been compared to and called concentration camps. Can you talk about these camps and whether they're even mentioned or included in Biden's latest policy shift?
Biden doesn't really mention them. I mean, as I mentioned before, people who aren't immediately expelled at the border will end up in ICE or CBP detention for some period of time while they're awaiting, you know, the travel arrangements that the government needs to make to expel them. And yes, I mean, the ICE detention system really, looking back at the history, really grew when we had a huge number of people from Haiti and Cuba coming to the United States in the early 90s. And that was really sort of the sort of historical moment when the ICE detention system really ballooned. And there's always been a racial undertone to ICE detention. It's grown hand in hand with mass incarceration in the United States. And so I don't think we can sort of separate U.S. imperialism, U.S. Policies around white supremacy from ICE detention, from the immigration system. And ICE detention centers themselves are just horrendous places where people really suffer abuse at the hands of people who work in the ICE detention centers. The food is often spoiled. They don't have adequate access to water, to basic hygiene products. Many of the folks out there may remember a couple years ago when there was the case of the forced hysterectomies on women who were detained at the Irwin County Detention Center. So, yeah, and that was just one example. It's really just emblematic of the system as a whole. There's no reason for it to exist. I mean, migration is just a part of human life. People move. People have always moved. And the idea that we can control it somehow by putting people in these horrendous settings is really appalling when you think about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm also curious kind of about the other side of this, because you mentioned a few times that people are just kind of dumped into Mexico. And this, of course, as Detention Watch has pointed out, these people are at a heightened risk of kidnapping, trafficking, and murder as they are, either left dumped into Mexico or waiting in Mexico to cross. Again, like I'm curious if the Biden administration has mentioned this at all. And I'm also curious if you know of how Mexico has responded to this.
Yeah, to be honest, I'm not, our focus at Detention Watch Network is really with the ICE detention system. I don't have a lot of stats off the top of my head in terms of how Mexico's responding. We know from our partners that, there have been countless violent acts that have occurred against people who have, you know, been stuck at the border in Mexico. The government has agreed with the United States in some way to accept these expulsions. So there's definitely some negotiation happening, but the Mexico is not equipped. You know, essentially what we're doing is offshoring our detention system into Mexico detaining people there and putting it on the Mexican government to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the punting that that the U.S. is very good at, particularly Democrats. And I kind of want to, I don't want to play devil's advocate. I just want to share what the devil's advocates are saying. Corporate media, I just scrolled through some examples, are saying that Biden's doing the best he can and that this is just a step on the road to more progressive policies, which I feel like the Democrats always say that. Like, look, we're going to take 10 steps back, but it's really part of our step forward. Meanwhile, and I did some Googling on this, and in his first 2 years, Trump signed 6 executive orders just on immigration alone. All told, he signed more than 200 executive orders. What realistically could Biden do right now to legitimately address this situation?
What could Biden do? He has, you know, immigration, is really in the control of the executive branch in many ways. The executive branch decides, you know, how to enforce our immigration laws. Today, President Biden could cancel contracts for immigration detention. That is fully within his power. He does not have to detain people. There are several contracts that are up for renewal this year. All he has to do is not renew them. That's it. He doesn't even have to do anything. So we could immediately get rid of several ICE detention centers this year simply by him not renewing these contracts. So I think that's one really easy thing. I think while the courts, Biden really dragged his feet on Title 42. Eventually, you know, there was a plan to lift it that has been blocked, but that court decision in no way told him that he had to expand Title 42. That was completely the Biden administration's own doing. So they can walk that back today. So there's really a lot, you know, they make the decisions on how to enforce our immigration laws, whether to expand Title 42, whether to renew ICE detention contracts. They, you know, while our immigration laws are problematic and need to be fixed, or not fixed, they're operating as intended. They need to be rewritten. There's a lot that Biden could do today if he was really interested in progressive immigration policy.
Yeah, and that is a big if. It would require a quite a significant change of heart. And I kind of wanted to expand the viewfinder there to include Congress, because this is also something that I feel like the Democrats are really good at. Like, look, my hands are tied. I really wish I could help you. I mean, we saw this with abortion, too. If we just had more Democrats, we would codify Roe v. Wade into law, which they could have done at any point in the past 50 years. I feel like when they do have control, they do nothing. And when they don't, they complain that they don't have control. And so their hands are tied. Based on your experience with specifically with this issue of detention and migration, what do you feel the likelihood is of an overhaul, either through Congress or what you were mentioning with the executive branch, in the near future?
I'm not very optimistic. Like you said, they had a chance just a couple months ago, just a few months, not even, right? Like a month ago. And they didn't do it. And now we have a Republican controlled House who is trying to do the exact, you know, basically like cement the worst of Trump's anti-immigrant policies. We have an administration that hasn't been putting up a real fight and has in fact really doubled down on those policies using the rhetoric of we want to do better, but in reality, they have co-signed to those policies. So I am not optimistic that things are going to change without a fight. What I am optimistic about is that we have a really vibrant immigrant rights community who is continuing to push the administration and Congress. Detention Watch Network is a membership-based organization. We have members across the country who are fighting locally in their communities to shut down ICE detention centers. And we've successfully pushed the administration to close several of them over the last 2 years. So I have hope in our people, and I have hope that if we continue to push, that eventually we will get to what we want, which is a world where people are able to move freely and who, you know, people aren't detained simply for migrating.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm glad that you, cause I always like to leave these conversations on a note of hope. And I'm glad that you pointed that out, because I think that there are so many examples throughout the history of our country, but also just in general, that governments don't do anything unless they're pushed to do them, but they can be pushed to forcefully make change, that aligns with not only human rights, but what, as you've pointed out a couple of times, what the people actually want. So thank you for pointing that out. And so I want to also ask how people can connect with your organization and any other ideas you might have for getting involved on this issue of detention and migration.
Absolutely. So our website is detentionwatchnetwork.org. We're all on all the social media platforms at Detention Watch. So definitely check us out there. In terms of getting involved, I think there's a system of over 200 ICE detention centers across the country. There's a good chance there's one near where you live. So find the people who are organizing to shut that facility down. Get involved locally. If you don't know who to get involved with, reach out to us. Definitely, I think our power comes from this sort of all of us doing our part at the local level and coming together to coordinate action to push the administration.
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to also point out that I think sometimes there's a lack of understanding of these systems, and ICE is younger than I am. These agencies are very new. So the idea that we couldn't live without them, or, oh, woe is me, what are we going to do? We've done fine without them before. So, there are many alternatives that would highlight human rights. And as you've pointed out, what people actually want. So, Zatara, thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
We wanna smash, crash, mash, mash, blast the system. We wanna get it hype, get it live, get with the mission. We want the crowd loud, this pumping rhythm is hitting.
And that does it for another episode of the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Eleanor Goldfield, co-hosting with Mickey Huff. For this episode, I've also been your associate producer, and Anthony Fest is our senior producer. Project Censored Radio airs on roughly 50 stations across the U.S. from Maui to New York, and you can find all our previous archived programs by going to projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram just before we get deplatformed, and be sure to subscribe to the official Project Censored Show on your digital tethering devices podcast application. Please feel free to contact us, share your feedback, or learn more about our work at projectcensored.org, and see our new publishing imprint, The Censored Press, at censoredpress.org. To learn more about my work or to contact me specifically, please visit my website at artkillingapathy.com. You can also follow me on social media at Radical Eleanor. Last but not least, thank you so much to our listeners for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
Remember, the whole reason New York City housing, the NYCHA housing, was built the way it was Corbusier understood that if he did not have light coming in every window, and if every room did not have air and light, people could not thrive. That was the whole reason for getting rid of the tenements that go with it.
Maureen Coates, environmental lawyer with Planet A Strategies. Hi, I'm Michael G. Haskins, host of Living for the City on WBAI 99.5 FM, Wednesdays at 11 a.m. Every week, myself and senior producer Jillian Jonas take an in-depth look at the city of New York as it is developing right before our very eyes. We bring on grassroots organizations fighting to have their voices heard in how the community in which they live will grow and prosper into the future. So tune in to Living for the City Wednesdays at 11 a.m. over listener-sponsored WBAI 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web.
Hi, this is Christian McBride, and you're listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web.